Born ready, yo. My clock says 3:30.
Go.
Boom. There it is.
I did it again.
There it is. My goodness.
Hello, everyone. Is it my turn to start talking? Sure.
It is.
Why not? It's Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the daily edition of our podcast where Kai and I try to read the words on the page and also make today make sense.
And in the process, somehow make today make sense. Oh, my God. All right. So today is... what do you want to know? Wednesday, our chance to answer your questions. You can send them to us, of course, at makemesmartatmarketplace.org. Just put questions in the subject line, and we will get to them on a Wednesday is when we'll get to them. Mm-hmm. So we're going to jump right in, and we're going to start with one of the biggest stories from a couple of months ago in this pandemic, the PPP. It was the Paycheck Protection Program, going to help businesses, intended to be small businesses, turned out some big businesses got it, to stabilize the economy. Actually, but here's what Mike Mills wants to know, and basically it's now what, and here's what he says. Lots of talk about the unemployment numbers recently, but there is one potentially huge factor that I have not heard anyone mention, and it's driving me crazy, the approaching end of PPP. He says he laid off all 50 of his employees in March when the pandemic shut down. He's in live entertainment. Fortunately, a local banker was able to get his PPP approved on the second day, and he hired all 50 back in April, which is great. But time's running out, and he wonders if people are going to have to return to the unemployment lines when PPP money runs out. And that's his big fear, that the unemployment rate is going to spike again. Shouldn't we expect that, he says. And the short answer is yes. A couple of things to be clear on here, though, just to make sure that everybody's not confused. President Trump signed the other day an extension of PPP forgiveness from 8 weeks to the end of the year, fundamentally. So don't worry about spending all your money on payroll in that 8 weeks. If you can get it and meter it out a little bit, you can be forgiven if it's spent appropriately by the end of the year. Number two, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said today, that, as part of that, adjustment, it had been, changed from you have to spend 75% of your PPP loan on payroll. That got knocked back to 60%, 60%. Mnuchin said on the Hill today, I think it was on the Hill. But anyway, he said it today. Look, even if you don't get to 60%, we're going to forgive those loans anyway. So do your accounting. Be super careful. But I would not stress about the forgiveness part of those loans. But what I would stress about, and this is for everybody,
yeah,
is that is not the PPP loan money running out, which would be bad. It's when unemployment, expanded unemployment benefits run out at the end of July. And August, we all fall off a cliff. Because not all the jobs are going to be back. Powell said today, Chair Powell at the Federal Reserve said, look, there's going to be millions of people unemployed for a very long time in this economy. And unemployment, as it stands now, the expanded unemployment benefits go away on the 1st of August. And that really, I think, is the root of Mike's question. That's what I think.
Well, I mean, I think it's both, right? If he's saying, I was able to hire all 50 back, and he's saying the money is gone... Right. The money, like even if he only had to spend 50 or 60% to get the loan
right.
forgiven, that if the money's gone, the money's gone. Like, I think it's I think both of those things are true. I think small businesses may burn through their loans.
Yep.
And frankly, may have burned through their loans based on the earlier guidance. Like, thanks for the change now,
yep.
all these weeks later.
Yep.
But like, I
After
already spent
hustled,
it keeping
right.
80%
yep.
of my staff on.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's frustrating that like. Mike, our listeners are better at predicting the fact that things are not going to be the same today with a surprisingly good jobs report that's not as good as they thought
yep.
and also still terrible is not the reality, you know,
right.
that even if all of that is the pseudo reality today, it's not going to be the reality in a few months. And so like, yes, I think the money is going to run out for a lot of people and there's no conversation about helping again.
Yep.
In fact, if anything, there's the opposite.
To be fair, so McConnell has changed from we're not doing another one to I want to make sure that we have certain protections and blah, blah, blah in the bill, which, you know, while ridiculous, is progress, right?
You know. It's progress, but they're still talking about end of summer as far as I,
yeah,
the last
sure.
I heard.
For sure.
And
for
that's,
sure.
you know,
and
probably cold comfort for.
They do not have the sense of urgency that Chair Powell, for one, would prefer that they have, as he said today.
Yep.
You know.
Yep. And cases continue to rise.
Well, we've given up on the coronavirus. We just have.
Apparently we have. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was at least a new study today. This is a bit of a departure, but there was at least one new study today out of Britain, I think, that said, like, look, if you all wear masks,
Oh, I know.
Which are increasingly proven to work. If you all wear masks, we can probably keep the curve flat without having to do more lockdowns.
Yep.
So to what extent that can be socialized, it seems like it'll help. Our next question comes from listener Dan Bakshund.
Sorry. Seems like it'll help. Sunshine. Yay.
Seems like it'll help. It'll help.
The crazy
guys,
thing is we have the power. We know how to do this. And I'm totally like, oh my God. I saw a tweet today that said, hey, you know what? If we all wear masks, we could avoid a second wave of this virus. And I'm like, you know what? If we had all worn masks, the first wave wouldn't have been so bad. Sorry.
Yeah. Yep. That too. But at least now. Yes.
Yeah.
There was a tweet from Zeynep. Now I'm just down this rabbit hole, but I can't stop. Zeynep Tufekci, who was one of the earliest proponents of wearing masks, and was like, guys, we got to really figure out our messaging on the mask situation, because I think you said no just so that you would protect PPE. Anyway, as a data point, there were two hairstylists in Missouri, both of whom were infected and symptomatic and kept cutting hair. Cut the hair of over 140 people.
Why would you?
Everybody was wearing masks because we're open now, Kai. We reopened. However, and Zeynep raised this to say that, of course, there was the whole the Twitter shame parade, right? Against these two people who were we're trying to make. However, they wore masks and all of their customers wore masks. And the incubation period has passed for all 140 plus people who got their hair cut by these two sick women. None of them got it.
None of them got it. Okay. All right.
Yep. It's one data point and there need to be more, but that is significant. They were symptomatic, cutting hair for 2 weeks while sick.
Yep.
So
fair enough.
There you go. Just put one on for God's sake.
No
doubt. We all have the same acne. Just work it out. All right. A question from our listener, Dan Bashand, who sent in a voice memo, which we love. We love it when you do this.
We do.
I'm just saying it's wonderful because we get to hear you and it's like a different person talking instead of our monologue. Anyway, here's Dan.
Hi, Molly and Kai. This is Dan from Austin, Texas. Kai has mentioned on a few occasions the growing disconnect between the economy and the market. So my question for the two of you is whether what we're seeing is the much maligned moral hazard coming to fruition.
Okay, wait. Was that Andy Euler? Did somebody put Andy Euler up to call? Because that was 100% Andy Euler.
It sounded
from Austin, Texas. Cut it out. Come on, man.
We're gonna have to edit them together, the voices.
Oh, man. Especially right in the beginning there. As you listened, it wasn't, but at the beginning, I'm like, oh, my God, it's Euler. So, super quick. No, this is not moral hazard. Moral hazard was what happened in the financial crisis when let's talk specifically big banks and the bailout, right? The big banks did bad things by securitizing the oomph de oomph out of all those mortgages and bundling them and selling them off. And they got AAA rated by the ratings people and we all bought them. And then when the housing market collapsed, everything went kerflooey, right? And then what happened was, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, called all the big banks into his office at the Treasury and said, here's $10 million. $10 billion rather. We are recapitalizing you. And he did this to 8 or 9 of the biggest banks, right? And he forced them to take this money. That was moral hazard. The banks did a big bad thing and the government bailed them out. And here's why. As Tim Geithner said to me in an interview about 2 years ago, look, your instinct when this happens is that you just let it burn. Let it burn. The big banks learn the lesson, everybody learns the lesson, and forget it, we move on. That, of course, is completely the wrong thing to do because, yes, the big banks learn a lesson, but so does the guy running a hardware store on Main Street in Ottumwa, Iowa, when he can't get his small business loan, right? And that's not what you want to have happen. So that was moral hazard. What's happening now is, once again, as Powell said today, the economy cratered in something like 2 months. And what the Fed has done and what the government has done is provide liquidity and cash so that we can keep the economy going to whatever degree we can while this virus sorts itself out. That's not a moral hazard. That's a rescue. And there are differences. Now, you can quibble with who's getting the Fed money and whether, the airline should have gotten bailout money, all of that, but it's not moral hazard.
So moral hazard, as I'm reading from Investopedia, thanks for the link, producers, is the idea that a party protected in some way from risk will act differently than if they didn't have that protection.
Mm-hmm.
Tenured professors becoming indifferent lecturers, people with theft insurance being less vigilant about where they park, salaried salespeople taking long breaks, and so on. That's not what's happening with markets where there's lots of liquidity and protection and trillions of dollars that's been injected into the market.
Well, first of all, it's not. It's literally to keep the economy going, which it was in the first place too. But in the first place in 2008, it was after a bad act, right? It was after a bad act by the banks. There were no bad acts in this crisis.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no bad behavior. I'm literally confused about. I don't know if it requires that always. Like, it's basically that you may
a tenured professor becoming an indifferent lecturer is a bad act, right?
Well, they're becoming indifferent as a result of the tenure. So, like, the idea that because you're protected. So I guess what he's saying is, if that's what moral hazard is, he's saying the reason the stock market is so high is because investors feel totally protected. So they're like comfortable with gambling to the extent that they're gambling.
Well, yeah. And look, let's be clear, right? The net result of what the Fed has done is to have boosted the stock market for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
But that was an after effect of providing the liquidity that keeps the economy going. Right. In the early days of this crisis, companies were not able to roll over their paper, right? They weren't able to roll over their debt and finance their continuing operations because the bond market had dried up. And that was the first move the Fed made. They cut rates to zero and they plowed a bunch of money into corporate bonds.
Right. Yeah. And I guess the question is, like, is the disconnect right or wrong? And that's the part we won't know for a while.
Yeah.
All right. Next, this one's on the same, a similar topic.
Here we
actually.
Go. Mike Visser of ICER, I don't know. Here's what he wants to know. Can we talk about the responsibility and silence from the investor class when it comes to systemic racism? Just yesterday, the 9th, Molly mentioned that IBM was getting out of the facial recognition business because of concerns over how it would be used by law enforcement. And as expected, their share price went down because less money coming in the door. We see this kind of thing all the time when a company tries to raise wages or offer more benefits. How do we non-investors get the markets to reward social good and not just what makes the most money? It's a great question. Also, for the record, Amazon came out this afternoon and said for a year, police are not going to be able to use its facial recognition programming.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Which is a big deal. I mean,
right.
How do we get the markets to reward social good is a conversation that I have actually had a couple of times now this week with respect to diverse hiring. And there is empirical evidence that companies and investors leave money on the table by not acting, at least in this case, by not having more diverse hiring. So, like, there's research out of Morgan Stanley that shows that investors who only invest in people who look just like them, white men, owned companies, are leaving potentially up to $4 trillion in unrealized value on the table. I quoted some research today from Intel and a consulting firm, Dahlberg, that said that the tech industry in particular, if it had more diverse hiring and therefore appealed to a broader base of customers, because it literally asked the people who work there, what should we do? And they were like, hey, you can reach a lot of customers with this. They could achieve an additional value of $300 billion to $370 billion per year. So, like, really, the way that we get markets to reward social good is to convince them that they are losing money for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like there's actually a capitalism argument here, and we should be, you know, angry investors and angry pension holders. Like, it's a lot of pension funds, right, that are invested in venture capital, and venture capitalists are leaving a bunch of money on the table because they. So, I mean, I don't know how you do that in a concerted way, but I can tell you that, like, there's an economic argument to be made, too, that it's not just social good. It's like, I don't know, don't build corporate infrastructure where it's going to wash away. Like, build in climate change as a risk. Think about diversity as an economic benefit.
Yeah. So, you know what I go back
also
to?
Do the right thing. Question.
Well, yeah, there's do the right thing. But once again, capitalism doesn't care whether you live or die, right? But I wonder if for all of those systemic things like climate change and all that, so I've talked and I ask people about whether this is a moment that the race conversation in this country is going to change. I wonder if it's going to have spillover effects to some of the other big long-term things like climate change that we've been going, you know, fingers in the air, la, 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 about, right, for certain segments of the society.
I mean, I think they're a very similar conversation, like the you know, the thing today, I'm going to go here, about the White House economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, saying to camera, I don't believe there's systemic racism in the U.S.
That was amazing. It was amazing.
It, like, this isn't a, like climate change, right? It is not a thing that you can believe or not believe, objectively, empirically, socially, economically. Like, you can have your reasons for pretending that one of these things is not real, but it's not a debate. And so, like, there are economic arguments for what we call the right thing that are not a debate. And I just am, I think that we will realize how intertwined these things all are, empirically, objectively, socially, and economically. And it'll contribute to hopefully lots of moments. I'm having a moment of positivity. I know this is weird.
No, it's all right. It's all right. But it's all good. So one of us has to, Molly Wood. One of us has to. All right. I got 3:46. I have to go troubleshoot all my equipment that failed this afternoon. So we are going to leave you. I know, right? A whole long story. Let's see. So tomorrow's Thursday. It's not Friday, sadly, but it's Thursday. And so we'll be back with the regular News Fix, Make Me Smile, and then we'll get out of your hair.
That's it.
That's what I got. We will.
You will wash that podcast right out of your hair. I don't know how often you're washing your hair these days, but it's probably not daily. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Maybe one of us. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Hethcote is our video producer. Ethan Peretz is our video intern. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and smart speaker explainers.
Charlton Thorpe was pushing the buttons down at the studio downtown. Today, our theme music was composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. There we go. There we go. Boom. No? Not the one.
No? Maybe?